So welcome everyone for our weekly class, Parsha of the Week, Parshat Noach, story of Noah, flooding the Tower of Babylon. So tonight we're going to focus in on one of two main stories in the weekly Torah reading. There really only are two stories. There's Noah and the flood, Noah and the Ark and the flood, and then there's the Tower of Babylon towards the end. Most of the Parsha, most of the stories, are what gives the Bible kind of a bad name. And that is the Begats. Are you familiar with the Begats? So you have all the generations, you know, from, let's say, Noah to Abraham. So you say, you know, Noah lived X amount of years, had a lot of children, had a wife. He lived X amount of time, cumulatively. He died next, and he begat so-and-so. So there's 10 generations that connect us there. Give me 1 second. Somebody's asking for the link. Just give me 1 second, everyone online. I'm going to fast forward a link to one of our great students here, if I have it. And if I don't have the link, I don't have the link. Okay, we are back. Hopefully, one of my all-time great students will be able to join us now. So, after you get through the Begats, and it's interesting, there are 20 generations that take us from the beginning of time, literally, Bereshit, the beginning of the world, until Abraham. And we know that the linchpin in between those 20 generations is right in the middle, Noah, who gave us the name of our weekly parsha, of our section. Interesting that 10 generations takes us from Adam to Noah, 10 from Noah to Abraham, and from Abraham begins the story, if you will, of the Jewish people, but not humanity. So really, when you look at the two first sections of the Torah, Bereshit, Genesis, Noah, there aren't any Jews in the Parsha until the very, very end. You don't meet Abraham and Sarah until the very, very end of the Parsha, and they, of course, are the first of our kind. And you could make an argument, are they, obviously they weren't born Jewish, what status do they have? So the rabbis believe that they have a special status. We call them Avot and Imahot, the archetypes, the patriarchs and the matriarchs. So they have their own standalone status, because in reality, until you have Mount Sinai and the Sinaitic covenant between the Jewish people and God, you don't really have Jewish people the way we are today. It's only at Sinai that the Jewish people, in fact, become the Jewish people, because we accept the Torah. We say yes to God's offer. Now, let's focus in on the antediluvian. Antediluvian, of course, means before the flood, and the post-diluvian world. So the antediluvian world, I only get to use that term once a year, so I love to use it. The antediluvian world, the world before the flood, became corrupt. Humans destroyed the world. Animals learned from humans, corrupted themselves, etc. And then God said, you know what? Game over. Let's start again. If you recall, what was there in the world before there was a viable earth? There was water. So day one, God separates the waters from above, waters from below. So clearly, if he is going to nullify the world and call it a day and recreate the world, it's obviously going to be with water. It's going to be with water. So Mayim, we know, is not only a reference to water, it's also a reference to Torah. We call Torah, Bible, Mayim Chayim, the water of life. So there's this duality to the nature of what it means. Okay, that's a side point. Now tonight, what I want to focus in on is the relationship between the post-diluvian world, the fears of mankind in that post-diluvian world, and then subsequently this creation of the Tower of Babel, Migdal Babel, the Tower of Babylon. Okay, so let's discuss then what happened after the flood. So we know God has a rainbow, and we have the rainbow covenant, if you will, between God and the people of the world, and he has a covenant, a bris. We use the word bris today only for circumcision. Hope none of you were protesting us Friday, were you? Okay. Apparently there were some people up protesting by the Wyoming Valley about circumcision. I would think in our world today there's maybe more to protest, but be that as it may. So we speak of bris, covenant, which, yes, could mean circumcision, but it also, more specifically, means just the nature of a relationship between God and mankind. So remember, it's a relationship between the B'nai Noah, the children of Noah, which means essentially every human being alive today. We are all descended from Noah. And in fact, we know that there are seven specific laws that define a person who is not Jewish, but chooses to live a righteous lifestyle. We call them Noahide laws. And they're the big ones, you know, murdering, adultery. Not, of course, before that. Murdering, adultery, pain to animals, etc. So you have the seven laws. They're called the Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noah, the seven commandments of the children of Noah. And that distinguishes humanity. So humanity was very terrified. They were scared. Because, yes, God promises not to blow the whistle and call the game again. But, you know, I guess humans know their limitations. They're also very much aware of the dark side of human nature. And so they come to this one little place. They call it Shinar. And it's somewhere in the Mesopotamia area. So anyone who travels to our friends over in Iran and Iraq, it's somewhere in that little area of Iran and Iraq today, present day. Now what's ironic, bitterly ironic for the Jewish people, is that the world was centered there, and then the tower is destroyed, or left bereft. But what happens to the Jewish people after the destruction of Temple Number 1? Where do they end up, ironically? You know where they end up? Back in Babylon again, which is unbelievable, right? The king Nebuchadnezzar destroys Temple Number 1, Solomon's Temple, in 592 before the Common Era, and the Jewish people are enslaved and captured. They're taken to Babylonia, and they create unbelievable Torah life and Jewish life in Babylonia, of all places, which is really amazing to think that there's this sort of full circle between the tower and then the ultimate continuity of Jewish life post-Churban Bais Rishon, post-destruction of Temple Number 1. So, let's now get to tonight's talk. Parshat Noah, flooding the Tower of Babylon. So I'm going to read to you. I'm not going to do screen sharing for those on Zoom tonight. I'm not going to do any screen sharing. And you're going to listen at home if you're on Zoom to the words. They're in English. I'm going to read to you directly from Scripture, from the Torah, from the Bible, a narrative description of the Tower of Babylon. It's not long, and it's very, very famous. Okay? So let me read it to you. Please follow along if you have the source sheet here. Source 1, Genesis 11, so we're in Perek Yud Aleph, verses Psukim Aleph to Tes 1 to 9. Now the entire earth was of one language and uniform words. And it came to pass when they traveled from the east, that they is referring to humanity, they found a valley in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and fire them thoroughly. So the bricks were to them for stones, and the clay was to them for mortar. And they said, again, humans to each other, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make ourselves a name, lest we be scattered upon the face of the entire earth. And the Lord descended to see the city and the tower that the sons of man had built. And the Lord said, lo, which is a nice way of saying, thumbs down. They are one people, and they all have one language. And this is what they have commenced to do? Now, will it not be withheld from them all that they have planned to do? Come, let us, referring to the angels, descend and confuse their language, so that one will not understand the language of his companion. And the Lord scattered them from there upon the face of the entire earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, he, God, uppercase H, named it Babel, Babel. For there the Lord confused the language of the entire earth, and from there the Lord scattered them upon the face of the entire earth. That is the entire narrative of the Tower of Babylon. So there's a whole bunch of questions that jump off the page, right? Let's just take them one by one. Question one. God is ticked off at humanity, the sons and daughters of mankind. That's my question. We don't know. I'm phrasing the question. What did they do wrong? It seems like a utopian paradise. They have one language. They have one philosophy. They're all together in this endeavor. They all seek to build this tower. It seems like a United Nations that is actually functional. Right? There's no Israel yet to hate. Sorry, couldn't resist that one. So this predates Israel. So the UN actually works. It sounds great. It's utopia. And God says, oh my gosh, this is a disaster. It's going to destroy, as the oral tradition explains, it's going to literally be the end of creation itself. It's over. If this is successful, call it a day. What? Okay, so let's examine. There's not a lot of information here, as you can see, right? It's very short and succinct for a big story. Everyone has this grandiose vision of the Tower of Babylon, but there are very few verses, 9 verses, that take us from the beginning to the end. So there's not a lot of meat on the bone, but we will take it slowly, okay? So they came from the east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. So question one is the following. How come you're wasting a couple of verses telling us, oh, let's make bricks instead of stones? Do we really care what the tower was made out of? I don't know. We'll come back to that. File that away for future important use, okay? And then they say the following, and this is maybe where they get off track. You ready? Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make ourselves a name, lest we be scattered upon the face of the entire earth. So some rabbis, some commentators say, this is the issue at hand. They wanted to fight God. They were worried that they would be nafuts, scattered. It's a real worry. Because after all, remember with the flood, it didn't work well. Now they're all in one little area, and they are petrified that they are going to be forced into exile all across the world, which ironically is exactly what happens as a result of the failed tower, right? You have this amazing surge of humanity, 70 primal languages, 70 primal nations, people go to the east, west, south, north, boom, the whole world is populated. Exactly what they didn't want to happen. So you could say, well, God got his desire, 100%. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any kosher Chinese food next week, right? Okay. Well, I mean, it's true. But is it so horrible to seek a name? So one could say, and the rabbis say, that's wrong. They were fighting against God. There was a declaration of war and contempt for God, and they were challenging God because they want to build it up to the heavens, wherever that is. Of course, it's not in our earth, but in their mind, metaphorically, they're trying to build this, you know, what is it called? The Burj Khalifa Tower, which is ironically probably not too far from where the Tower of Babylon was, right? That's that 2,700... very nice target, by the way, God forbid, if you're a terrorist, you know. You want to fly planes. It's like right there in the United Arab Emirates. That was the one that Tom Cruise is holding on with one hand outside, you know, 1,800 feet up in Mission Impossible. That's the Burj Khalifa, tallest building in the world. So they want to build a Burj Khalifa because they want to sort of attack heaven from below. Well, that's not good. If that's their intention, in other words, not the reality. Obviously, they're never going to really reach heaven, but they're building the tower symbolically to lay siege to God. So that's not good. So that's one of the approaches of some of the commentaries, is that perhaps that's the issue at hand. But again, God seems to be very upset, and he even reiterates, they have one language, one culture, and this is what they're going to do? It's almost as if that's an issue too. So we have to answer that. So question one was, do we care about whether it's bricks or stone? Question two, what was the real crime? And why does God accentuate the idea that they have the one language and the one culture, the one philosophy, when, I don't know, it seems like a nice idea. Or maybe There's a dark side that we'll discover. Okay? And then, what happens? God ends up confusing the languages. So the Midrash says something fabulous. You ready? Everybody had two languages. They all spoke God language, Hebrew, what we call the Holy Tongue, Lashon HaKodesh. It was sort of like the English of those days. And they also had their little tribal languages that they spoke. But they could converse with each other in this common tongue of God's language. So when they're building the project, they're conversing with each other in God's language. And how did God confuse them, according to some commentators? They simply forgot Hebrew. And they only knew their little tribal dialects. And then it was impossible for them to work together. So as the Medrash puts it, a guy asks for a hammer, and his friend misinterprets his request and ends up hitting him across the head with a 2x4. And they, you know, got into fights, and eventually the project was waylaid and left, never completed. Okay? A little bit like, you remember Ozymandias, the great poem by Shelley? So that seems to be, again, I'm not in Percy Bysshe Shelley's mind, but Shelley, and I don't have the poem offhand, but essentially it's about a king who wanted to reign forever, at least that his legacy should live forever. And he builds this enormous tower-like edifice. And he says that he once, you know, met a traveler from a distant land who came upon this great edifice, and it looks, and it says, you know, oh, all travelers, look upon me in awe and shake and tremble in fear. I, Ozymandias. And then the poem ends with powerful words, and beyond that lay nothing but desert and sand. Like, that was his domain, right? That was the dominion of this great Ozymandias, was basically looking after cacti and scorpions. So again, that might be an approach that we could use, that mankind wanted to stamp its eternal name. Because remember, name is another word for renown, to gain renown. They're arrogant and they're haughty and they're challenging God. So that, again, that could be very distasteful if you're God. Is it considered a horrible crime that we equate? We call this the Dor Haflaga, the generation of the dispersal, and we almost equate them, we mix them and match them with the Dor HaMabul, with the actual generation of the flood. Well, the generation of flood were downright evil. I mean, horrible people, except for Noah and his family. They were relative righteous people. But here, why would you conflate the idea of a desire for renown and maybe misplaced ego? Why would you conflate that with the flood? It's very strange. Yes, Doc.
Because very simply, they went from building with stone to building with brick and mortar.
They went from building with stone to building with brick and mortar. How is that germane? What do you mean?
That they know this to get together and build this tower. They assume that they have reached the pinnacle
of human societal evolution.
Of development of science.
Okay. Very good. And you're and
God says,
right. Okay. So Dr. Kelman is saying that perhaps in their arrogance, they reached what was then cutting-edge technology. They had this huge fiery furnace, which became the symbol. You know, all the stamps, all the forever stamps that you mailed in Babylonia would have a picture of the Kifshan Ha'esh, the huge boiling oven. And that oven became the symbol of the entire Babylonian Empire. Okay, so let's back up. And I like what you said, because I'm going to take that and take it with a little slightly different tact, but you're right on. So thank you for that, Doc. Okay, let's take this apart. We have all heard of isms that we've had in our world, you know, in the 20th century. And some of them on paper sound really nice. Utopian. However, when they are put into practice, many of these isms, and I'm referring specifically to fascism, socialism, communism, etc., they just don't work in reality. Maybe on paper, you know, when Karl Marx wrote it down and he said, oh, well, that sounds great that we could have this equality. But in reality, there hasn't been a society ever in history that's ever functioned with the vision that maybe he had. So in other words, theoretically, maybe it's a great idea. I don't know. But in practicality, humans enter the parsha, they enter the story, and humans corrupt it. Now, how do you know that humans corrupt? It's very simple. You know when you knew the Soviet Union was not long for this world? When they were basically con artists, right? So you had Leonid Brezhnev. Remember Brezhnev? He was, at least when I was a kid, he was the big guy, the big mocker, okay? Served for a ton of years as the office was, chairman, vice, whatever he was, okay? I know they had two or three people, but Brezhnev was at the top of the food chain. So for Brezhnev and his fellow comrades who were at the top of the food chain, I know this is going to come as a shock to you, but they didn't line up for 5 hours for potatoes, right? They're, you know, in Russia, they used to just have lines, and people would just join the line. Because whatever it was, they probably didn't have it. And they would ask the guy in front of you, you know, well, what are we waiting for? Oh, well, there's a rush on, you know, celery from the Ukraine. Oh, okay, we'll wait in line. But the ruling class opted out of this. They had dachas on the Black Sea to enjoy their holiday time. They had chauffeured limousines to take them around. And you can bet that they never waited in potato or celery lines for their food. So as soon as you have a corruption where there's a class that's a ruling class, even though it's not supposed to exist, right? You're not supposed to have a ruling class in such an ism. But that's the point. Now, why do I mention this? Because this is exactly what happened here. And it was invented here in our Parsha. In other words, Brezhnev, Marx, none of these guys, it was nothing new. There was a man, a real character, and he's actually a historical character. His name was King Nimrod. N-I-M-R-O-D. And King Nimrod, this Nimrodian vision, was this vision of a totalitarian type state. And there was enforcement from above on the poor masses below. But, of course, the rules don't apply to Nimrod, or to his family, or to his friends. They apply to the munchkins down below, not the guys above. So, remember how we spoke about the UN? God says, oh, they have one language. They have one culture, one philosophy. This is what they're doing? So why was he angry, we said? It sounds great. It's not great, though. You know what's not great about it? It's enforced from above. It's not freedom of choice. The people didn't get up one day and say, oh, yeah, lovely, let's all speak the same language, let's all have the same culture. No, this was the culture that Nimrod declared is the culture. This is the religion that is the religion. And if you want to have any, you want to not go with us, guess what happens to people who say, I don't want to get along? Well, remember the oven they had to fire up the bricks? That oven was a place of suppression of anyone who was discontented with the life. So anyone who protested was thrown and immolated in that oven. You remember the story where Abraham was 48 years old, and he was ultimately tossed unceremoniously into that Kivshan Ha'esh. So in other words, this Kivshan Ha'esh, this giant furnace was kept at hundreds and hundreds of degrees, was for brick making, yes, but it was also to destroy would-be Abrahams of the world who maybe had other ideas about God and about the culture and philosophy. So they did not tolerate any type of dissension. Dissent, you wound up roasted extra crispy. Okay. So therefore, when we speak of a language and a culture that is uniform, when we speak of uniformity, we're speaking of enforced uniformity. That's a totally different game. Do you hear the difference? In other words, it's not that they woke up one day and said, oh, this is fantastic, this is great, let's all get along, kumbaya. No. You either conformed, or if you dissented, you wound up extra crispy. Yes, Michael?
Where is that information?
It's all in the oral tradition, in the Talmud and the oral tradition.
Okay.
I'll give you the source notes after, but it's way beyond our purview and
that's a lot to
I know. Okay.
With just this.
Well, that's why we're having fun with it, because the text itself, Michael, is just the beginning. It's like it's not even a layer. There are multiple layers that you have to sort of carve away to bring the essence of what's going on. Because you can see that this little segment that I read is severely lacking in information. There really isn't a lot of information to validate God's negativity, right? Why is God so negative? Well, now we know that there's an enforced conformity from above. Okay, let's take this further now. Okay? Nimrod, then, this Nimrodian vision was the antithesis of creation. And this is why it's so crucial that they went from using Evan, stone, as Dr. Kelman said, to using bricks. Let me ask you, are there any two rocks in the world that are identical? No, it's impossible. Now, I know to the human eye, yes. You put it under an electron microscope, no. Who shapes rocks? Nature, God, creation. That's why they're not identical. So what did they desire? Throw away God. God's not in the discussion anymore. We're going to invent cutting-edge technology, as you said, which will allow us to build billions and billions of multiple identical little building units called mortar, bricks. And they will be literally identical and replaceable. And this is a metaphor for how they viewed humanity. Humanity became just units. Units of exchange. There's a fabulous little medrash, an oral tradition, which you may have heard. Now, the tower gets tall. So let's pick an arbitrary number, okay? 1,000 feet up. Now, you can imagine, back then, how difficult it was to ascend the tower. It was big. It took a long time to get people up there. I don't know how much they got paid for their endeavor. And then it's even harder to get the bricks up there. So the project should keep going. So the Medrash fabulously says that as the project got underway, as is often the case, people lost sight of the reason behind the project, and the project became the be-all, end-all of the civilization that they had created. So much so that they became desensitized to the value of human life. Brick life became paramount, not human life. So the oral tradition in the Medrash says, if a human being would fall to his death from the tower, okay, send up another human. But if a brick fell, oh my gosh, we're behind production. They would cry and they would lament because we're behind production. So in other words, the project stripped away any of the humanity that Nimrod had allowed to exist, and it all became about the uniformity of the bricks. And that was the culture. It's amazing. Now, you might say, come on, it's an exaggeration that somehow this is going to destroy creation itself. Actually, it isn't. Source 2 and 3. And I'll just paraphrase for those on Zoom, okay? So during creation, specifically day number 3, God ordained that vegetation should rise out of the soil. Trees, herbage, grass, etc. And God commanded the trees to be unique. And he said to the trees, he gave, like, when I say said, it means he hardwired into the information of nature that trees should not share genetics. Trees, by definition, grow apart with the roots and because of their size. And he said to the trees, be unique. Don't share with other trees. So you have an apple tree here and a cherry tree here. They must remain distinct from one another. Do not cross-pollinate. Do not cross-breed. But the grass was never given such an order. And yet, guess what happened? When the reality of the trees and the reality of the grass came up, the grass emulated the trees. And in the same way that the trees that did not share their genetics to be distinct, to remain unique, so too the grass, the herbage, was unique. Now, how did this happen? What's the significance of this? You see, if you think about it for a moment, let's pretend that when God hardwires nature, it's like a computer program. But it's God's computer program, and you have an operating system, even better than iOS, a little better. And we love iOS. Remember, it was the apple in the Garden of Eden. It has to be the iOS. So, come on, that was good. That was good. The Apple operating system. So everything in nature is hardwired. You can call it whatever you want, but it's nature. God ordained it should be so. There's no freedom of choice by plants and by animals, only by humans. Okay. So the trees were given their direction. It's a computer program. Do this. Grow this way. Do not share DNA. Grass, we're not given this program. But guess what the grass did? On its own, and again, I don't know how you use this as a metaphor. Have fun with this one. The grass came up on its own with a fortiori argument. An a fortiori argument from Latin, as our esteemed colleague here, Mr. Esquire, Mr. Yellen, will tell us. An a fortiori argument is the following. You say like this. If at age 21, Babe Ruth, who was in the prime of his physical existence, could hit a baseball 420 feet, right, at age 21, surely when he was, 19 or 20, even a little earlier, he probably had that same physical strength. Or you can do the reverse or the opposite. Or you could say that, when Babe was 32, he was over the hill, he couldn't run the bases. For sure, when he was 35, he couldn't run the bases. So you can, it's a thought process that the rabbis use in the Talmud. So here's what the grass came up with. Now, obviously, grass doesn't talk and think. So the rabbis are applying this to the thought process. The grass said, look, we're just grass. Humans walk over us. They don't even know what we are. Now, you'd be surprised to learn that there's like thousands of types of grass in the world. So if you are in the world of someone who is a botanist, you'd say, no, rabbi, what are you talking about? The synagogue has this type of grass outside, and there's that species over there, right? But for us, we just see grass. But it's not true, right? So they said like this to themselves. Trees, which are distinct, and every human knows how to identify a tree by name and by the fruit, they're given the directive by God to be distinct. However, much more so, the grass said, we should be distinct because by definition, people don't even look at us as being distinct. So therefore, they did it on their own. And guess what God said? And every day in your prayers, we say, Yehi chavod Hashem le'olam yismach Hashem b'masav. God rejoiced over his creation. You know when he rejoiced for the first time? When the grass, on its own, so to speak, decided to be distinct and not to share genetics. So what does that show you? What is the primary focus of creation? Uniqueness. In other words, if you're grass, if you're a tree, if you're a human being, you are unique. This is what creation is about. And when the grass got it right for the first time without a directive from God, God rejoiced. Oh my gosh, creation has worked. So can you imagine a King Nimrod saying, no more, no more stones. We're going to be uniform units. The bricks, no stones. Humans, one language, one philosophy. Dissent will not be tolerated. This is the evil, pernicious mindset of the Nimrodian version of the world. And this is why God had to mix up the humans and scatter them to the four corners of the earth. Because had this been allowed to proceed, it would have been the end of creation. Because we all would have been vanilla. You would have gone to Baskin Robbins, you said, where are my 31 flavors? Do you like vanilla? No? Sorry. That would have, again, I love vanilla, it's okay. But that would have been the end of creation. There would have been vanilla or vanilla. Whatever your choices are. So how does this relate to us going forward? Very simple. Each of us has been imbued with unique characteristics, with uniqueness. Treasure that uniqueness. Hone your own unique skills, your own philosophy, the way you look at the world. Because the way you see the world, the way you have a vision and how you interpret things and how you see Torah and how you see your relationships, it is unique. There is not one human being in the history of the world that could ever say he's you, or you could say he's him, he. You're unique. You're not bricks and mortar. You're unique. And this is the greatness of creation. This is the uniqueness of each person. We all have our own mission in this world. And no one else can sub for you in accomplishing that mission. So we should all, at the beginning of this year, this new year that we just began with Rosh Hashanah, we should all celebrate our own uniqueness And it's okay to like the Red Sox or the Yankees, or even the Phillies or whoever. That's what makes it fun. I mean, can you imagine playing in a league where there's only one team allowed? It wouldn't be very much fun. There'd be no competition. It'd be boring. The whole idea is you got to have someone to cheer against. You got to have a synagogue that you don't daven at. It's fun to have difference of opinion. That's what we're about. That's why we should celebrate when people say, you know what, Rabbi, I don't agree. That's good. I like it. Defend yourself, but I like it. So we should all merit the blessing of uniqueness. I wish everyone a wonderful evening.